Please ask people in the seat some other time where they are. Now, there's some cockamamie attendance policy requirement. It was cockamamie tested last year, wasn't it? And it says that I have to give like 3 formal warnings over the course of 3 months that at some point I might take attendance, and at some later point I can't take attendance, and I issue another warning. And at some point, if you're still not showing up to class, I can fuck you. So, consider this warning number one. I plan to start taking attendance. Okay, well, that's starting class on a great note. I thought it would be useful, even though our mics are having issues, to say the least, to open it up a little bit. So the second half of the class, don't worry, what you've been waiting for, which is an intense discussion of exactly how encryption works, is dead ahead. But I wanted to pause to refresh. And we've had an intense series of a few events over the course of a couple days. You've been to some or all of them. Some of you not here, but you've been to none of them. And at some point, we'll find out who you are. I'm just interested in impressions from any of the events. We had Leslie Valenti on Sunday. We had the new court yesterday afternoon. Then we had the 2 ICANN events. Sadly, most of you only went to the first one. It was far less interesting, I assure you, than the second one. After people lose the cover. Let me just open the floor and go double fisted on microphones for people to react. This was a problem yesterday, too, during the ICANN session, right? It was supposed to be the dialogue from the students, and what happened was we got 2 different reporters asking questions. So one over to Karen Hall, and then let's get one up to this zone, and then just after you're done, pass it towards the next person who has a hand up. Karen, go ahead.
One of the things that struck me about, I went to the Leslie Valenti and the academic, and it kind of struck me the role that money was playing, like where people were coming from. At first, it started, the Valenti Leslie very particularly, started sounding, like very high principles and stuff, and it very quickly became clear to me that Valenti was being paid to go there and be small and smarmy, and, I don't want to offend anyone who's like a big money fan, but he was basically there as a lobbyist, and he wasn't having a very successful time in even responding to Lessig's debates, because he wasn't coming back from a point of what can be the best situation for the internet. It was just how can people that I represent keep the most money.
Yeah, I think some of the reactions were, wow, Lenny was in a little over his head with a law professor arguing the intricacies of Follow-up 1 of the DMCA app. Poor guy. Indeed, when that word of this started going out to publicity, Barlow actually wrote it. He said, let me at him. What do you mean, Wesley? Let me, Barlow, go at him. I'm ignorant about the law, too. In some ways, it would have been perhaps more interesting and fewer ships passing the night debate were it to have them sort of arguing on the ought of the ethical principles, is really stealing the debate, and Barlow really had a different view. But to be sure, I think Valenti is a good example of somebody who is paid, and quite proudly so, to say the right things. He is, in that sense, an advocate, almost a lawyer-like figure. At dinner, he was regaled with details of the deposition in the CSS case. That's how they followed the link to the deposition. Which is quite an interesting read. The lawyer objecting all the time about compound play. That wasn't read like a long order script at all. And, Valenti at dinner just offered up. He was responding. He said, I had so much fun at that deposition. I said, really? Because I'm looking at the transcript. And at one point he says, I have 140-week fever. I don't recall this. And maybe I need a break for a glass of wine. He said, yeah, I got that other attorney. I gave him nothing. And, boy, do I know how it's done. In some sense, he's there to argue what he can, and if cornered, even said it once. If you don't have the law on your side, argue the facts. If you don't have the facts on your side, argue the law. And at some point, if Congress did something he likes, they don't need to argue the principle. Just say, I defer to Congress. You've got a problem with time to that. I think he quite joyfully does it. And maybe the larger point for us to consider as the proto-policymakers, if we are sometimes in this class, how do you structure a system in which Jack Valenti can be at home? If the system presumes that everybody is a good actor just aspiring to balance everything, it doesn't necessarily take into account the fact that plenty of people at the table have a distinct monetary interest. Keep that thinking about in space as well. That's plenty of people around the table that have a distinct interest. And I don't know if there are other thoughts on that or just separate comments. Mary Ann,
one comment I wanted to make is on Malinke as well. Ace is funded in her quiz, which was at that piece. You can see that sort of thing, just seem charming and nice and affable. But the problem was I was shocked because he just didn't seem to get it. I mean, he just didn't seem to be doing as good a job as the lobbyist as I thought he should be, because he didn't seem to understand the technological fear, or the fear that the technology that's emerging could actually hinder fair use. And it's sort of a revelation at the end that perhaps he fully understood it and didn't want to go on record as saying something that he didn't want to say. But if he was either ignorant of the point or didn't come up with an answer, right. To me, that was disappointing.
Well, for all I just implied about he's crazy like a fox, my sense was that he hadn't really the kind of orange blob motion point. Too bad we never responded to their feeding paralyzed one. That is a relatively good point. The way we are getting a very odd view of the internet, because it is, certainly a minority view. And it's shared, I think, in large part by Leslie, so you've heard it reinforced a lot that evening. That is a new view. I mean, the world at large is living in the world of Napster and Nutella and anarchy. And the idea that somehow right around the corner is the technology actually locking stuff up real time is highly counterintuitive. So far here.
It's fun for us to be on the cutting edge, so that's great. I would imagine that Disney and Sony and a few others might understand it pretty well.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, at least Jack, it improves Jack enough that in his opening statement he said, by the way, I'm hiring a real whippersnapper in 2 weeks who's going to, really help us on the technological front. Find a way to work this out. The other thing to realize, and this might have been an interesting colloquy we've gotten to the Malinke with, DVDs themselves, digital video discs, are regionally encoded. That is to say, you buy a DVD in the United States of America, it will not play in the Netherlands. You pop it into your DVD player in the Netherlands, nothing happens. This isn't because of some mistake. This is because of a strategy by which you can do international phasing of movies out, just as you do in theaters, right? If you ever travel away from the United States, you'll see that Greece is still playing in Greece as the first one movie. So there's somehow a delay of stuff getting out from Hollywood. It is not just explained by slow-moving frigates. So in that sense, DVDs are meant to replicate that pattern. That's a great example then of having the technology defeat some aspect of the first sale doctrine. I cannot sell my DVD to somebody in the Netherlands. And people know it's going to be charged from a differential rate for it as a result. And we probably should think we could start really honing it down. Release country music in Boston and make it cheap as hell. Country music in Austin, Texas is quite expensive, and you can't do the arbitration. Another hands up, the microphones actually circulating? Go ahead.
They are. I think we should be proud of my card and trust.
Yeah, please bring your cards. I hate to sound like a tyrant with my late line attendance, but we're struggling to try to make us feel like a small class, and showing up helps, paradoxically, since it increases the number of people in the room, but so too do these cards. Hey, Glenn.
Anyway, one issue that I think would have been great if we would have made, or you, or Mr. Wessing, would have made Jack Malinke answer is that taking music that is not yours is stealing. Therefore, what should happen to all the 15-year-olds in the world who have stolen? In other words, does Jack Malinke and the motion picture industry really want to be the people who are calling for the imprisonment of half of the 15-year-old and 16-year-old college-age population of the country? And I just would have loved to have seen him answer that question.
Right. I assume he would either answer, I don't recall, which would be a non sequitur, or he would say, it is stealing. Let's at least agree on that. Now, shall we put them in jail? No. I'm a generous man. I temper justice with mercy. But what we do is call their parents or call their school and try to get the school to acknowledge it is wide-scale stealing and shut it down. How many of you have followed up on what Harvard's response to the Napster letter is? So, just Amanda, tell us, what did Harvard say?
They said that they
weren't gonna shut, they weren't gonna shut off access to Napster, but then today I saw in the paper that they're actually due to too much volume of inquiries into the Harvard system. They're making it more difficult for people to get things off the Harvard system, but people can, on the Harvard system, can still download stuff from elsewhere.
It's actually a brilliant answer on several levels, not anticipated by anyone's rotisserie answer. But the brilliant answer is, we're not going to restrict Harvard students' use of Napster. Let's go to town. However, due to network constraints, we will identify and filter out outgoing Napster packets. So if you try to share your stuff with others not on the Harvard campus, it won't go anywhere. Now, you know, this is not, I want my MTV. You can have your MTV, you just can't give it to anybody else. So it's kind of brilliant because it may be a neatly asymmetric rule by which people aren't going to pour out their dorm rooms and stand with fists united in Harvard Yard. How dare you? And on the other hand, it is doing some contribution to get rid of Napster as the free runner.
I think they're also being really careful to suggest that it was a volume issue, not a moral or legal issue, and
yes,
thus leave the door open if they wanted to change it in some way.
Yes. In the next update, I'll forward to all of you the official notice of the FAS confusion position. I don't know, interesting question would be, if that applies to the law school campus. My guess is that it does, because the law school rents network bandwidth from FAS. Is the other microphone now this way to somebody who wants to say something?
Okay.
How does this work? You speak
into it, and... I attended the IQ debate last night over webcast, which was amazing.
Oh.
That was fantastic.
That's where everybody was last night. We're all on webcast. And in fact, my heart was injured.
I was very impressed, actually. Partly, I don't know anybody. It was different than one person sitting in the room, but it was much more interesting, actually, because you could watch the candidates talk and hear them talk. It was actually pretty high-quality video. The candidates were all typing in the answers at the same time that they were talking to the questions that were up on the screen. So you could read their back and forth banter. And there was an online web chat from people who were logged in watching. So I just thought that was very well done. The one thing that I noticed both out of the class time debate and the one panel last night was that they all seem to have completely different concepts of what ICANN should be. And it never really was, anybody ever explicitly explained what they thought it should be and how that would fit in with the world. And so I just thought that was an interesting thing to notice, given that they're all vying for this one position, that they would have completely different concepts of what ICANN's purpose should be.
Yeah. Now, there is a Q&A forum on the ICANN site by which you can ask questions, and the candidates are some way committed to answer them. So far, prior to yesterday, the only way the candidates have kind of been delayed to the electorate and set before Emerson Tilbert, who appears to be doing this weird handout leaflets to people on driving trail in Texas. And it might be an interesting question to ask them. You can find out a way to frame it so they don't just go off in paragraphs of leather. I'd be curious to know the answer. Where's the other microphone? Anybody knows?
Yeah, I actually wanted to say that those candidates represent the best of what ICANN leadership has to offer, this of what ICANN leadership will be, then ICANN's in a lot of trouble.
Really?
I don't think any of them realize the, and I asked them this, and everyone evaded my question, what they'll do if the U.S. Congress essentially preempts ICANN. And they said, well, we have to, you know, make sure that countries know that everyone, that we're, you know, trying to represent everyone's interests, but I don't think any of them realize that they haven't conquered the idea of the nation state yet. And while the internet may in time do that, they don't have enough time to convince the United States Congress and the developing world and the European Union that what they're doing is in everyone's best interest. So I think as soon as one of them, as soon as they take any action that will help one of them, the others will freak out. And I don't think any of them see that. And I think Lessig was probably the only one who realized that that's a problem. All the others just seem to say, oh, you know, we'll come up with the best system for everyone.
Yeah.
That, and I thought the industry guy was probably the slimiest person I've seen in a long time. And I've seen plenty of speak in other forums.
You've never been to Washington.
Oh, I have, but usually they don't send them out into environments where there are non-slimy people around. So there's a contrast that's quite nice there.
I actually was in the same hearing that he was describing. I testified just after him, and his that much of a distance to delay this hearing and to convene the test of network solutions, which involves one of the congressmen in Virginia, the Western area. And it meant to kind of take IHAM out, and the exact opposite happened. It's quite fascinating to see. And most of the witnesses smell it immediately. Does he have a microphone?
The response that I had was back to the Valenti Lessig discussion. And the one thing I thought that was interesting is that I thought that Valenti almost tried to preempt a lot of the comments that people like myself made, like the rotisserie. Because one of the questions that I had was the MPAA actually thinking of a new business model. And that's one of the first things he said is, oh, we're coming up with a new business model, we're going to have this digital strategy department, we're doing all these things. It's like, I thought it was very crafty for him to kind of almost preempt a lot, what a lot of students, I think, first response would be to the MPA, like, what are you doing to try to bridge the gap between the movie industry, the entertainment industry, and people who want to do things online?
Yeah, as much as he seemed willing to demonize the graduating class of Stanford, for example, for having lax moral values, he does seem to agree that the industry as a whole has understood that the reason so much piracy is taking place is just because there's no great alternative. That if they can figure out a way to offer a legal alternative that just costs you a dime or a nickel or $30 a month on cable, people won't steal cable so much. I think there is widespread agreement on that. There's the other one.
I was going to say, in response to what someone said before about what Valenti was saying about technology and him not understanding it, how dangerous it could be, and him not thinking you need to phase. I think he actually did reply, and Lessig actually pinned it down quite near the end. And he said that he was in favour of having fair use, and he actually said that he did against something that took away the idea of fair use, and he'd actually tried to protect it. And since, I might be being late, but since he's the person who's like in charge of this new business model and this new guy they're getting in, if this new guy comes up to him and says, yeah, we've got this great new way, we've got anyone selling it ever again, we'll control everything, I think he'd say, no, I don't want to do that. So,
I don't know.
That seems to be the problem.
Because
I might be
the guy who brought you the original encoding, right?
Sorry?
This is the guy that bought you DVD and regional
encoding. Yeah, I can understand that the reason behind the regional encoding, is slightly different from controlling the way that everyone's talking about.
So he would never do the San Antonio, Boston regional encoding. He would stop at national boundaries.
Yeah. And it's not just that. Yeah. It seems to be what you were saying. I mean, yeah. I bought it made up this.
Yeah.
Very
I don't know. Where's the other mic? Go ahead.
I guess in line with the last comment, I thought one of the things that sort of bothered me about the Valenti Lessig debate was that there wasn't any, it was a very hostile crowd, and I think in general it was hostile towards Valenti. I kind of wanted to see anyone stand up for him. And I mean, honestly, I probably wouldn't do it either, but I felt that there should have been some sort of, I mean, he didn't have the greatest grasp of the argument, or perhaps he was just punking them, one way or the other. I was hoping someone would stand up for his side of it,
right,
and give some sort of reasoned argument against Lessig. I thought some of the arguments Lessig made weren't necessarily as strong as he presented us, and certainly when we're sitting there agreeing with him, we say, okay, yeah, that's, you're a smart man. But I, just thinking about it later on, I felt some of the, he was talking about a lot of constitutional stuff that I'm not sure, and he probably knows better than I do, but still, someone should challenge him a little bit. Anyway.
Well, I'll tell you, if next time we do the event, I actually think there will be a next time, we'll actually have a sort of an annual thing, we'll actually be somebody. my idea would be either to ask one to bring his lawyer with him, actually have a little, acting backup or something. And secondly, to actually designate people from the class who want to be lawyers for the lefty. Presume you are a lawyer, whatever your personal views, this guy writes your paycheck. And, say it like you mean it and see how you can back him up. I think that would be quite an interesting exercise. And we have a number of other guest panels and things, and maybe they don't have more time to just into it. I agree, we'd get at the issues better if it wasn't just one gladiator, however spirited, in the middle of the arena. Here's next, Mike.
Yeah. We've discussed a little bit of the industry, just going to move ahead with technological solutions. I'm sure not very much. I mean, obviously, they're going to try to get a lot of data, but they're going to go ahead with technological solutions. response to that was that anyone else in the firm or the person on the right to sort of act against the church. And I was wondering if I could get, if I had a chance to ask him a question, I told him to ask if he's not scared by the results of that kind of encryption arms race. Does he think that sort of the side he wants to win isn't going to win? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I can't represent Lessig's view on it. I am personally baffled that so far those scholars who have engaged in it, Lessig's work, Willie Cohen, Andrew Brett, and another, have only gone so far as to press for a First Amendment right to hack, or to try to hack, which then leads to the arms race you're talking about, which does seem to leave the outcome of the policy balance in just who can better arm themselves. It does seem a weird way to decide the issue. You know, we should either just flip for it, or we should have an affirmative First Amendment right, as such there should be, to fair use. Not to even just try to hack for it, but just to have it. So they can lock it up as tight as they want, but there'd be some way you could, you know, send a self-addressed stamp envelope that says, I'd like page 37 of this book, and, you know, it constitutes fair use, please send it. I have yet to read a whole lot of literature. There's one note from the Stanford Law Review that by a student really gets at that, and you may have seen my paper referred to it basically the one on trusted systems. But it's actually quite wide open to do it, possibly because it's so politically difficult to achieve right now. Where's the other mic? It's a really well. Yeah, go ahead.
Just in terms of the Valenti-Lessig debate, I thought it was pretty unfair to Valenti to have so many people involved in a lawsuit against him basically have it as a form to just slam the guy, and I'm not trying to criticize the moderator here, but like those guys just have like minutes and minutes to just tell their story in front of a very supportive crowd. And I thought Clint actually did a really good job of, you know, trying to keep it unemotional. But yeah, it just seemed like even when he came into a situation where the other side guessed that that was like a particularly bad
slam. We strayed a little bit from the kind of substantive internet stuff, but it's an interesting point. I thought the first fellow to speak, a.k.a. Emanuel Goldstein's 1984 fame, was quite articulate, and to my mind as a moderator, had some license to go on a little bit because he was such a player, and it truly was. You know, the FDA was the plaintiff, he's the first name defendant. I agree that by the time Eric Harvey got up there, Eric had sort of, he was on all cylinders, really going strong. And in a way, in my experience in these things, when you do open up before, you take some risks already, and they often follow the model of what has come before. And Valenti and Lessig had been so happily in each other's faces and were up to each other. It was a very small leap for the audience members to try to do that too. And, you know, you get Valenti asking a question right back at the guy, clearly then he's going to come back. So I agree that there's a sort of sense in the room as it goes on, we either this is interesting and we're moving the ball, and at some point there's a moment where it's just awkward. And we did that a couple of times in that discussion. Yeah, where's the next mic?
Yeah, I think it wasn't just a problem of Valenti not willing or being unable to engage Lessig's kind of legal arguments. It was Lessig's unwillingness or inability or disinterest in engaging some of the broader policy things that Valenti touched on, some that he did. Some of it is the trade issue, where there's a huge positive balance of trade for the United States in intellectual property, and how attractive this can be to the general public if getting rid of intellectual property or substantially reducing it comes at the cost of a tremendous amount of American jobs. Another might be, what are the distributional effects of NAFTA? Is it poor people with slow connections or no connections who are getting music for free, or some people in offices with T1 lines or advantage college students who have Ethernet connections who are getting music for free, driving up the cost of music, software, of movies eventually, so that poor people can still go into stores and buy these products kind of in the old way. And I think part of the reason that it passed 417 to nothing in Congress is that people on the kind of intellectual internet fringe failed to articulate a reason to most people why NAFTA is going to make their lives better, and failed to respond to the ones of why it might make the lives of many people worse.
Yeah, I wish you'd been at the mic on Sunday night. it's an interesting question, and there is an element to Napster that I at least detected when we went over that on Napster Day of guilty pleasure. You know, people are like, yeah, I use Napster, and there was a sense of not it's making the world a better place so much, which is kind of what Arlo would maybe appear, but just, hey, I do it because everyone else is doing it, and it's fun, and it's free. So I agree, coming up with a constructive case is hard, and even Larry seemed a little ambiguous. I think different answers went different directions as to whether the meat and potatoes use of Napster, say the typical use put to it by somebody in this class, should constitute fair use or not. Not does on the law, but should it. Larry did a lawyerly thing and said, well, under the actual statute, they didn't bother to draft it with this in mind, so I think it escapes and then you could go to Congress and impose the rule. That, of course, doesn't address exactly what you're talking about, which is the overall issues of moving on it to be closed or not. Is it a better place with the law prohibiting it or not? Who's your mic? Yeah, Ben.
My comment is sort of about blessing already. I can't the comments on the green and blessing law plans to talk about it. But this idea is about ICANN sort of works for me in the sense that talking about ICANN has no legitimacy, but that doesn't seem to want ICANN to do anything to give it legitimacy. And then he also is obviously very concerned with code or law or whatever it is being made by companies, which I agree is a problem, but then he doesn't want ICANN, it seems to me anyway, to do anything about it. ICANN might not be perfect. But I feel like no one does anything about it, and companies will just keep doing what they're doing. But I didn't go to the meeting, so maybe
nice for me. For what it's worth, and maybe I should share this off with the candidates, I sense that a lot of them are speaking truly as classic candidates do. A lot of stuff to take shots at, a lot of stuff to say, screwed up, and when I get there, I'll figure out how to fix it. And it will be interesting to see whoever among the 81 wins, unless it's Harris, who doesn't need to put law. But whoever among the 81 wins, how much they end up moderating their position, you know, once they're actually having to go on. I see this on the transparency and due process point. I mean, people really hammered home. You know, there is no due process, there's no review. These documents are posted on a Friday and they go into effect on Monday. And I think a powerful practical answer to that is give me a break. If we posted those documents two Fridays before, you can tell me anybody would read them and meaningfully reply by the next Monday anyway. You know, yeah, we can pro forma do it, but it's not like it's gonna make a difference. And that happens to a lot of things. I mean, a classic way a policy proposal gets to ICANN, as we discussed it, is it initiates itself in the Maine's Council, it gets reflected with the constituencies, it comes back to the Maine's Council, where it then is posted for public comment, it then goes back to Maine's Council once more for agreed upon cooling off period, then there's an amendment, then another public comment, then up to the board then sends it to the other parallel councils, the Maine's Councils, the address supporting organization, and the protocol supporting organization, then it goes back to the board, then the board puts out public comment, then it gets passed. And once it gets passed, you can apply to reconsider. The board decides whether or not to reconsider after a cooling off period. If they deny your motion to reconsider, you can apply to have it reviewed in an independent review panel, completely separate from the reconsideration panel, looks at it and decides whether or not to tell the board that they think it's wrong. It's a regular thing. If they do tell the board that they think it's wrong, the board has to think about it for 2 weeks, and then by a different vote, a supermajority, assert they still think it's the right decision, at which point it becomes policy. The entire process, I think, has to take at least 3 months. And, you know, to me that is a due process? I don't know. It's a Byzantine mess. And in practice, what it's meant is when I can actually have to make a fast decision, they just ignore the process entirely and just the word voted 7-5 and do X and away you go. So.
Do you have a better, more sort of specific idea of what Lessig's vision of ICANN is? Like what? It seems to me that he just wanted to get rid of it.
I don't know. I think it feeds back to the question over here on the same subject. The candidates didn't well distinguish themselves on what their vision is. It'd be a useful thing to ask them. It's directed by email. I think if they reply, you can share it with us or in that Q&A form. I'm not so sure. But again, also thinking paper topics, one thing a lawyer is quite often called upon to do is to be the proceduralist. I mean, as a civ pro at large, inventing a system so that when the losers lose, they feel like they got a fair shake, And in fact, they did. A system that makes it results that are not prone to error because there was the proper balance of efficiency getting things through, but also checks and balances to make sure the wrong thing doesn't happen. The right parties who might have an interesting view get hurt. And I think ICANN, at many levels, is crying out for that kind of analysis, and there's nobody really in a position to do it, except perhaps people in this room willing to take on that project. The right, is it in this vicinity? Isn't the right, oh, somehow the rights have all navigated that way. So no, after you go, get it back this way.
I think one of the debates when it's made clear, people always think that the companies are winning on the technology side, but when they made clear that they're winning also on both sides. The DMCA is the extension of the copyright term. So if you like, Valentis is winning Lessig's court a lot. And in this respect, I appreciate Lessig's step not to stay yet, having built up a step forward to run for candidacy to try and change things. And that why I was so surprised to see that what he's saying that we should do as little as possible. I mean, at least in ICANN, there is, or there will be Lessig's or other of the participants who really care. The decisions won't be taken by ICANN, they will be taken by corporations. There's not even one lesson, so I'd rather see less of the decision than somebody else.
Yeah. How many of you actually registered members of ICANN? Wow. The rest of you is too late for this round. So at some point I'll be curious to know how you all voted, and don't make me hack the system to find out how you voted and why. Yeah.
I'm probably exposing my ignorance here, but I don't think I agree with Leslie on much anything. I guess my question, one of my questions about, I guess, he seems to elevate fair use to like the level of constitutional right, and I guess I'm confused is where that comes from, because I talked to him before, that defense against, you know, someone supposedly copyright infringing something, so where does it get this elevated place in First Amendment protection when it's really just a defense for someone who uses someone else's stuff?
Well, I mean, this kind of gets at, again, multiple hats saying this class that we're wearing, you know, advocate or policymaker or constitutionalist or proceduralist. There's a line to be walked between saying that, on one hand, this is the way the law is, fair use is defined as a defense to contrary to yada yada yada. And then you can start the process of what Lessig is called translation. We say, how do we project this properly into the space? And it may well be that Congress were to repeal fair use. Section 109, I think it's Section 109 of the Copyright Act, or 107, is hereby repealed. That's it. That it might, in fact, be unconstitutional. It's never been tested. But that there has been some theory and dicta from the Supreme Court that says the only thing that makes copyright work is that there are these carve-outs. So if you end up with a de facto scheme by which the carve-outs no longer exist, and it's the government, through something like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that is seeing to it that those carve-outs disappear because it criminalizes hacking and for fair use, then the argument would go, that's unconstitutional. But I agree, it's not, you know, not by any means a slam dunk, but you've got to have kind of a fertile imagination to get it going. And you've got to keep in mind, asking Congress to do something isn't the right policy, saying, irrespective of what Congress does, especially in this case where we think it was captured.
Makes this point somewhat wistfully. He always says he's training tomorrow's Valentis.
And yeah, he has another hat to wear in class as mercenary, in addition to all the other hats that he's wearing. For what it's worth, I found in prior iterations of this class that there's an interesting kind of transformation of attitude that's why Albie becomes the pro. As my outbeat comes and goes, and I've actually tried out a time and cadence of the class to that quite specifically. The day after you get back from file week, should you decide to come back, we call it sort of roughly e-commerce day. Our e-commerce day is not a sort of blind description of how digital signatures work, so that's the second half of the class today, but rather a chance to actually meet some people on the front lines, some entrepreneurs, some of them are graduates of this school who have chosen quite unusual and risky and interesting careers. Last year around this time, we were doing Victory Labs, mp3.com, just kind of public, and Jordan Recall, HLS97, was running around saying that he was a very happy guy. He may come back, but not he was happy. I think their share price was around 60 when we visited, so 4.5 right now. So I think he's only a multi-millionaire. But anyway, I agree, that's definitely something to be bearing in mind as we look at this. So, yeah.
Yeah, you said, I guess I agree to a certain extent with Leslie's concerns, to a certain extent, because the European, I still do have some problems in seeing copyright enforcement a problem in an age where you have more and more possibilities of changing copyright. Then after a month of internet society, I may change my views a little bit. Still, maybe, don't you think that maybe Lessig's concerns are a little bit exaggerated in the sense that, for example, we constantly say that there is no right to fair use under the Constitution, but I don't know if this is useful or not, but the DMCA itself uses the phrase right to fair use. Which in my view means that, okay, I agree, it is possible that with technical measures you can prevent people from, you know, from fair use, but don't you think that it is possible under the existing copyright laws to invoke something like a right to fair use? Don't you think that maybe Lessig is exaggerating in his overall picture of copyright holders, you know, having more and more rights, and the general public having less and less rights, which are constitutional.
Yeah.
So maybe just an elderly, for example, just to finish and then I shut up. The problems Valenti had at the end, when Lessig was found with more and more extreme, and in my view, more and more absurd ways on how could copyright holder company encroach users' fair use with absurd license clauses, he showed to have some problems in understanding that. I don't know if he was acting or not, but I myself, when I started reading materials about that, did have the same problems.
Yeah.
So maybe just because I come from Europe, and in Europe, still the danger is perceived to be on the part of the hacker. Just a comment.
Yeah, I mean, this gets to maybe something that justifies the existence of a class called Cyberbot that was created as a whole. The whole was created as parts, where we try to identify, are there enduring features of technology or these networks of technology, it makes sense to study it as a stovepipe, even as we're scrambling. And I'm sure we all feel it, particularly because this is a survey course without the requisite, you know, to pull together and weave together con law, antitrust, copyright, trademark, and all that at once. And this is a long way of saying that perhaps one enduring feature of the technology, unless it invokes it in today's readings, is this concept of Janus technologies, the happy face and the sad face. And what it means to him is that a technology that appears to be going one way, the internet is, bless you, taking you ineluctably towards more and more anarchy and chaos and copyright infringement, can just as suddenly do a 90-degree or 180-degree turn and take you, well, this was the orange blob complex, a long way of doing it was the orange blob. And, I don't know, it's still highly speculative. I mean, they're in just year five of the modern web and the net. And the way I put it when asked about the Microsoft case is that there are two phases. Phase one is too early to tell. It's just way too speculative to know as a policymaker what
do. And phase two is too late to do anything about it. We've already built out the network, here are the parties at the table, don't tell me it's not politically feasible to change it.
The Bobby facility to have this enormous grid of operations, you know, hindering this poor individual patterns, but not to have antitrust. I mean, I read on the hearing CUCAD and the Congress, and you yourself mentioned antitrust as a possible way to prevent such extreme technological
interference.
I guess my point is, I'm not sure if intellectual property rights are the right battlefield to prevent, you know, to prevent freedom.
Right. Well, in the class on antitrust, we will ask the question, we have antitrust rules, and how will it work? Because it's certainly a doctrinal toolbox that is varied, and you know, if it is the policy maker, how well does antitrust suit for what you're trying to do? And of course, the bridge to make with intellectual property is, make no mistake, you can use a monopoly. It's a government-commanded monopoly, immediately then exempt in most cases from antitrust application. It's explicitly given to you so that you can extract monopoly rents. Why is software more than the marginal cost of producing a CD? Because you can't get a monopoly from anybody but the manufacturer. So anyway, we'll get into that as we get into the antitrust stuff. There's a mic over here. Is it? We're still using kind of as the talking wand, even though it doesn't hear your voice. Yeah, go ahead.
It doesn't work, but I just have a question.
Yeah.
You kind of scared me as a blind that he was really charming and nice. I actually called him Dad, and I thought he was very made up again. And I do agree with that. I wish that there was someone for him to kind of back, grow to the background. But it also scared me that he didn't know. So he made decisions on technology, but he didn't know some of these things that he was making decisions about. And that kind of makes me think that. This might be a little unbearable too, but if he's in the same like category of each of the judges are making decisions in these cases, like how many of these judges can we say no need to use the technology? And is it like an appropriate arena to make decisions like this? And maybe what's another option? What's the downside of doing it like an arbitration proceeding where one side takes one person, one side takes the other, and both sides agree on the third person? I mean, it seems like you get. I mean, I don't want to make it like a you versus a, like the age thing, but someone who's more in tune to what they were suing for. Like, I was just shocked he didn't know that he was, or, but then you don't know the facts either. Like, is he claiming in the records to be case, or things like that?
The MPAA is a claim, it's an institutional claim. It's not Jack Warren personally suing them out of these common sense of allegations. That's a point that's been raised a lot, that the courts and even the Congress are ill-equipped to handle these complicated technical questions. I ask each of you to pretend to be nominated to the D.C. Circuit or the Supreme Court or something, and ask to decide some of these things, like the Napster decision. I mean, how well did we manage in 90 frenetic minutes to actually walk through the Napster decision and feel that we came out with an understanding of how the damn thing worked, much less a sense of how to apply the law to it. There have been a couple of instances in which we have seen the legal and policy establishment formally throw up its hands and defer to technocrats on things. Patent law has specialized courts because sometimes it's just too complicated, even though you look at it at times with juries to make decisions as to whether a patent infringes and thereby cost $3 billion in damages or not to somebody. And you see it in economic and monetary policy. You know, Federal Reserve, not only for political reasons, but sometimes reasons of expertise is thought to be a part of things. And I don't want to offer you an answer, I just think it is an interesting question. But one, at least again, one of the unstated premises of this course today is we can dig in enough to it, and more people should. Because Barbara Simon's pained answer, I don't know, was this the later one or the earlier one? I think it was the second one, so few of you saw it unless you were on the webcast. When I said, is it your hope that Joe Sixpack can participate in ICANN? Is that how open you want to be? And she really had to think about it. I said, I don't know. And, you know. So, is the other mic? Yeah.
It's kind of just a couple of things over there a little bit, but I'm really confused about, like, I kind of feel like some people really, like, most people might get to decide what happens with the master, but I don't think the emotion liability on into like either of those communities. And the legal arguments must come up also, obviously. So
this is the emotional field, why you move to
why like less I don't really feel like there's even a public policy argument that I really do. I feel like it's like working somewhere because people feel it, but I don't think it's I can't find the articulation.
The people of Lessig Circle, we've been hard about this through a conference May a year ago, in which they basically all lamented that this was exactly the case. And the closest they've come is to try to invoke the environmental movement. Say somehow we are in the pre-environmental movement. Forests in cyberspace are being burned down somehow, and we need to figure out a way to articulate how we need to protect them and how it's going to happen. But they haven't yet hit home, if you're right. They're casting around. They're looking for a leader, a beacon, who can put in persuasive rhetorical terms, you know, what's going on here. I mean, it's loosely this problem in the comments. But I agree with you a little bit on open code day, this sort of grass trying to tell you something, but you can't quite hear it. There's a mic over here.
Yeah, I'm still using the mic as the indicator.
Yeah, but
I didn't see the whole blessing thing, so I'm not sure if I can walk on this. Okay, you're addressed. Lessig really worried about fair use. It seemed to almost approach like it was the first time. It was the first time ever that we had to deal with a limit on fair use. Before the VCR, which was presumably fair use for TV, which you couldn't record it. But and when CDs first came out, everybody switched over to putting their software on CDs. Before the CD burner became a regular means over the top of your PlayStation games, you didn't have a CD burner, and so you couldn't copy the CDs, and
right.
There's presumably a fair use protection for that software, though.
Right.
And so I guess maybe he's disturbed by the overt desire in encryption and to prevent you, but there's been covert methods of preventing people from using their fair use rights for a long time.
This, to me, is a very deep question about baselines. What are the proper baselines by which we vindicate speech rights? And you see it actually, I think it may be a sign in one of the sessions, in the oral argument of the ACLU v. Reno case, which was the challenge to the Communications Decency Act, which made it a felony to put anything onto the internet that was indecent, which has a specific definition, if anyone knows what it is, it's very specific. If you put such material onto the internet and don't make an effort to keep kids from seeing it, you go to jail for a long time. That was the Communications Decency Act. And there was a challenge to it by people who said, wait a minute, we can't tell a kid from an adult on the net. So that means to put anything on the net, we have to assume kids will see it. So you are basically preventing indecent material from going anywhere on the internet, which would be unconstitutional. So that was sort of the gravamen of the case. But the oral argument, Scalia said, there was a time when radio first existed, when anybody could set up a little transmitter in an attic and just lab on, other people can tune in, and they, you know, make way for each other as the spectrum started to fill. And at some point, we needed a Federal Radio Commission, later Federal Communications Commission, to sort out the spectrum and impose a whole raft of requirements on things. And, you know, too bad, that's the way it worked, you know? Before there was radio, you didn't have any freedom to broadcast, so what are you complaining about? And by implication, what Scalia was suggesting, before there was an internet, you had no means of taking a scandalous rumor and cranking it out costlessly to millions of people calling yourself drudge. How can you invoke the First Amendment right to do it now? But again, it depends on whether the baseline of what needs to be allowed under the First Amendment ought to move as the technology becomes
less. It seems to think now that we've got this costless transportation, that we should automatically make sure fair use is forever protected at a really high level, even if it costs a lot of non-fair use. But would it be prevented people from switching their software from disk to CD? That would have been an option at one point when they were only making 20 meg programs on a disk, and you just make them do 20, you know, instead of one CD, 16 disks.
Yeah.
That used to write off Microsoft Word and didn't have a CD player.
Yeah.
Would you have wanted to make them do that? Obviously, one of the motivations in switching to CD software was their delusions that people would be able to copy.
Yeah, well, some people might. Julie Collins wrote an article again, not about CDs in particular, about self-help mechanisms in software, not unlike the time lifelines and exercises and rotisseries, and what should happen with it. So at some point, the baseline shifts enough and is sort of mass enough. It's one thing to have it happen with obscure software that, you know, 10, 15% of the population uses for limited tasks. It's another to have the primary mechanism by which ideas circulate, books, get locked up tight or not. So you might argue
it's more than even a lock.
Yeah, that was true. We have narrow than a master manuscript. It's true. Let's do two more with the lights. Yeah, that's here.
I was really tempted to see IBM as some sort of, as the root of some sort of visionary global non-commercial, non-political governance force, like 100 years now forward. And I was really struck by this point of the way it's been messed up and how no one really had any idea what the definition of the job was that we're running for. I was wondering your personal view on this is, is I going to be around in 4 or 5 years? I mean, is this, are they just going to take it over less from outside commercial force?
Yeah. So I'm both to say this, but I urge you to read my congressional testimony on this subject, where I hypothesize what the alternatives to IGNR, what the chances of success are, and what will happen next. So that's on my little publications page, and it's also in the Berkeley Technology. So I hate to tune in to 11th of these cats, but it's a good question. And where's the mic cap then?
I just wanted to make one comment about going back to some of Leslie's point of learning that the is-odd distinction in terms of their use. And Michelle, I wanted to make a comment about the report.
Yeah.
What's striking about that is how many, everyone in the room that was there that day seems to believe that Leslie should win. Or something. I mean, I don't know. It seemed like everyone, I mean, maybe relying on lack of background here, maybe this is the point of the move for it, but it seemed like everyone in the room there felt like that was the right side, and it was just a matter of somehow couching the legal arguments in just the right way so as to bring about that result. And I'm curious about maybe just what your sense is of how true that actually is, and what your sense is. Maybe in the Berkman Center, what the chances of this lawsuit actually are, and whether maybe it should succeed on its legal merits versus on its sort of outside of legal merits.
Yeah, I think it's an uphill climb on the legal merits. I think the law is difficult. It's not what we would call Rule 11 sanctionable to make the argument. It's not so out of bounds that, what are you thinking? But it's a real uphill climb, and I've arranged to get us a transcript of the actual DC Circuit argument. They won't release the tape of it until after the case has been decided. Don't ask me why. And I'm not allowed to tape it until after the case has been decided. But they will give us a transcript, and we should have it 2 days after the argument. So I will share it with all of you. It's D.H. Ginsburg, a former professor here, which I take to be a good sign. Professors entertain crazy ideas in a way that all the people don't. And Henderson and Santel, Henderson did not say a word in the transcript this month, of course. Still waters for me. I think it's an uphill climb, but I, at least, and there are huge arguments in the annals of legal scholarship about this, I think that often the heart of effective litigation is to get people thinking you're right first, and then the details follow in the wake of it. You're the judge, you want to do the right thing. Who is getting screwed over here? And how can you help them? Occasionally, somebody's getting screwed over, but they just misdrafted the law. So then you write an opinion that flags it. I'm sorry, but I cannot offer relief, but Congress should really take this up. But in many instances, there's certain ambiguity. Does limited time mean there is a limit, and then you can't change it? That's plausible. And if it does mean that, in this case of first impression, unless it wins. Retroactive cannot succeed. So if you convince people that actually the public is getting screwed, I think that's how you win. You just got to figure out how to get government along with it. Let me turn now to, it's 5:15, I guess. Let me turn to some of the encryption stuff right now, and then if we've got some time at the end, I want to do a sort of feedback exercise, and then maybe we can open it up again. I thank you all, though, for it's kind of nice to talk to us, even in such a big group. Okay, so let's talk about encryption. Lessig says in his book, and by the way, the book is at the Coop, so I urge you to buy it, even though we've ripped off large chunks of it. I know, is it fair use? Is Lessig upset at this? I don't know, I didn't ask permission. Lessig in his book says that encryption is the most important technology to have hit us collectively in 1,000 years. And that's a pretty hefty statement, right? He then goes on to say, it's not as if you really need to know how it works, and it doesn't really describe how it works. I think it would be helpful to have a sense of how it works, particularly because on Monday, if all goes well, we will have some more guests. We're going to have the guy from the FBI who chose the unfortunate name Carnivore for their quite innocuous system of monitoring certain emails at internet service providers and creating what still is a maelstrom of attention on this one little aspect of government surveillance. So we're going to treat that as a case study on Monday. We're also going to have Simpson Garfinkel here, who is a quite, that's right, Simpson Garfinkel. No relation to Simon and Garfunkel. Don't get started. But anyway, Simpson is going to be here, and he's a very interesting guy, and we may also have Jeff Schiller here, I think, from Milwaukee, from MIT, who is one of the smartest people you'll meet and knows this stuff inside out. So that would be useful to take some time now to get some of the basics down, so we'll be unleashing balance on Monday. We're running that much faster, and can really understand how encryption starts to fit into this patchwork rebuilding of the policy issues of speech, privacy, and property on the net. So, all right, how does it work? Yes? Oh, no, I don't think I need that. I have slides, but no, let's go blind. Let's use my course. I'm going to pick up a piece of chalk, and this is chalk, right? Proof of this. Okay, so how does encryption work?
We're going for broke today.
Okay, how does it work? Step one. Suppose I have something I want to tell you, and I have no idea who between you and me is going to see it. It's a written message I'm going to send from me to you, and I don't want somebody in the middle to get their prying eyes on it. Now, in the internet context, this could be particularly important, and we should detour rapidly into a little bit of internet architecture to understand this. I think it's something I've mentioned before in my normal quick pace, so let me just emphasize it again. Right, we have these little ashtrays in which there are Ethernet jacks, and you can plug in and use your Ethernet. And in fact, I can walk back here now and see people using their internet and
surfing around.
Old programs used to have that "Here comes the boss" button, and like a spreadsheet would pop up. you plug into the Ethernet. And you send packets around. We already know from day one that on the internet, each point of presence, for which a computer counts as a point of presence, is assigned a unique number that ultimately came from John Postel and today comes from ICANN in its IANA function. See, IANA still exists, even though it was just John. It exists as a function. It's the IANA function, and ICANN performs it. So, okay, it comes from ICANN. And Harvard has a good batch of them, and it's assigning these numbers on a dynamic basis as you plug in. To you, you borrow that number for the time that you're plugged in. If you have a cable modem at home, typically you have the same number day in and day out assigned by your cable company, same with DSL, although you reserve the right to change it. And you identify others on the net by their internet protocol numbers, perhaps giving that number to your domain name resolution in the first instance. And you send packets down to a router, and you say to the router, this packet is going to 24.127.0.19. And that router has to decide in what direction to send the packet. And the first decision it has to make is, does that packet have a short distance to go? Is it actually intended for somebody else in the room? And all of you in this room, if you're plugged in on the net, have very similar IP addresses. They all begin with the same three numbers. And it's only that last number that's varying from one in the room. What it means actually is there may be a limit, at least on one subrouter, of 255 computers that we can hook up in this room before it'll be nice when you meet another router to deal with things. But in this instance then, if a packet comes in and the first three numbers have been taken care of, it's just a question of that last number. Which computer in the room deserves the packet? It goes to all of them. Every single computer gets the packet. And the computer to whom it belongs opens it and looks at it. The computers to whom it does not belong simply ignore it. Ethernet cards are designed to ignore packets that aren't meant for them. And that's why if you ever have actually an Ethernet card with that little LED that flashes whenever it's active, even if you're not typing or sending email, that LED is flashing because packets are zooming by it, intended to and from other people on your subnet. And if that's a cable modem connection, it means that you're actually looking at other people on your neighborhood who are sharing your subnet with you on a common router. Simpson actually used this to find out who was in his network neighborhood and started accessing the hard drives of nearby people, and Tom told his cable company, and they were not happy with him. So you might want to ask him about that after class on Monday. So, as we discussed, there's a way of sniffing. You can sniff packets. It's aided by the presence of a promiscuous Ethernet card. A promiscuous Ethernet card being one that sniffs every packet that comes by and tells you about it, rather than just the ones that are designated only for it. This makes it then quite easy to surveil network traffic that's happening. And remember, on the bucket brigade theory of how a packet actually gets from one end of the internet to the other, what I've shown you so far in that diagram, if you'll recall, is the cloud. Somehow it goes in the cloud one end from Harvard, passing on the internet cloud, and comes out the other end to some server in Finland that has the song you want from Napster. What happens in the middle? It is not like a phone company that just dedicates a particular fiber optic line or something to your little conversation and off it goes. Instead, it gets passed like a bucket brigade to willing intermediaries along the way who carry that packet. So Harvard, for example, may have a number of packets coming in. I've said this before, maybe I have. Harvard may have a number of packets coming in that actually aren't designated for anybody at Harvard. Instead, they're coming in because somebody's routing table decided that Harvard would know how to move them closer to the destination. And Harvard, indeed, instead of sending them downwind to people on the Harvard net, sends them off laterally, off the other end, towards the ultimate destination, wherever it may be. And what that means is Harvard is in a position to, if they wanted, surveil a bunch of packets going through, including packets that weren't specifically meant for it. Of course, you may naturally wonder, why does Harvard do this? Not why do they surveil them, but why carry them at all? It's like asking you to go to your mailbox and see that there is some mail for the next door neighbor that was put in your box by your next door neighbor on the other side who only wanted to walk one house, and now you're expected to send it on its way after filtering your own mail out. And the answer is, on the internet, people used to be friendly. They deliver mail to my neighbors. And that way you didn't need a postman. You don't need a postman. This system is unbelievable. You just put your mail in your box, or at least in the box of somebody next door. And if next door is closer to the destination, they'll put it to their next door and their next door, and on it'll go, and it'll get there in a number of hops. And we actually measure how many hops it takes. And often these hops happen in a matter of milliseconds, and your packet gets where it's going. This is truly then a distributed network with no central postmaster. But it does mean, again, if you think about security, that anybody along the middle, should he or she choose to, could be looking at those packets and trying to figure out what's inside and who's sending them, et cetera, et cetera. So people have been kind of sensitive to information security issues as soon as a network was set up that has such good graces that it's relying upon to keep the packets moving. Any questions on that much before I then show my presentation? Useful. Is this a short one?
Very
short. Is it like a comment on policy or is it actually a clarification question?
Okay,
say it out
loud. Are there anything that is precise moment somebody can see which web they went on?
Well, put more exactly, somebody somewhere in between you and the server out in the world that's serving up the web page you're looking at passed that packet from here to there. And if that person wanted to, installing the proper hardware and software, could have chosen to look at that packet And if you look at a pile of packets, eventually they add up to a web page and have a sense of what somebody using the IP address that you were assigned today was doing. That's right.
So we empower them more easily for security?
Well, Harvard might be in a position to do it, since all packets from this room are routing through the science center. So something the science center can sit there with a virtual megaphone inverted and listen. It's actually against the Harvard network policy for any of us to do that. You could be thrown off the Harvard network if you are caught using a permissive Ethernet card. How, you might ask, could you be caught using a permissive Ethernet card? It's not clear. Because after all, your card is getting goods. It's just electing not to look at it. But if they find you with one, you could be in big trouble.
The source ISP designate which linear media is
Literally, there are a set of routing tables, and if you are a node on the net, and there's packets coming to one end, you just consult your table to see who to pass these to, this hot potato to next. And you may not know the ultimate destination, you just need to know what zone happens next. Now, to be clear, the way the internet has since evolved, oftentimes there's only 3 or 4 hops to get from here to there. This isn't the same as literally passing from mailboxes across America. And it's usually AT&T or MCI in the middle of doing it. 3 years ago, there was no economic formula to figure out who to charge for what for carrying all these packets laterally. If you're AT&T, you're doing a lot of lateral carriage and very little sort of internal carriage. They've since started to evolve quite fascinating models of recoupment of packets and fees that feed into the work that's going in to make some packets go faster and be more equal than others. If we're lucky, maybe we'll get Dave Clark here to talk about that. I mean, I talk about it with Dave Clark. Okay, so encryption might be quite useful. So let's just run through it, because you've seen it like 8 times in the readings, and I read it in the readings. And I gotta say, you look at it, and you look at it again, and it's like, what the hell are they talking about? So here's one more chance. Here we have a message. Suppose the message is hi. And we want to send it off to somebody. Now, we could send HI off to somebody. In fact, there's so-called ASCII code that assigns a number to each letter. A, capital A, is 65 in ASCII. So we have a way of converting to numbers and putting numbers to bits and bits of packets, and then packets go off with the message. But how can we encrypt it? Well, suppose we know that these things have certain numbers. Just suppose this is number 5, and this is number 7. And this is a published list. We're not trying to keep a secret here. Converting the letters into numbers. And we want to then send 57 from here over to here, but in the middle we want it to be encrypted. So it has to come out high on the other end. One way to do it, a time-honored method, is to use so-called symmetric encryption. And let's just come up with a very simple scheme. We will generate what we call a PAD, a series of random numbers. Alright, so I'm just going to generate a series of random numbers. Here I go, 2 and 3. Those are my random numbers. And ahead of time, to my recipient over here, I'm going to give them that list of random numbers. So I go up to Monty, and I give him the 2 and the 3, so he has it on his side. And we're ready to go. At this point, I simply add the numbers in to say. So 5 plus 2 is 7. And 7 plus 3 is 10, and I now have the numbers 7 and 10. Note that if it had been H and H, it would be 5 plus 2 is 7, and then 5 plus 3 is 8. You have 2 different numbers, even though it's the same letter, because we're just going sequentially down to this pad. And this pad could have this pad could have any number of numbers on it, right? So if the pad is long enough, we can just keep going with these random numbers, encrypting our message downward. And somebody in the middle that sees a 7 and a 10, if they don't know this pad, they've got no clue as to the message inside, right? Without the pad, it's just a 7 and a 10, and they might know that there's numbers in here, but they don't know what they are. It's absolutely hopeless to figure out how to sort it out. But indeed, this is basically uncrackable encryption. Right here on the board, ready for execution. The only drawback to it is pads have to be pretty long. The longer they are, the more secure they are. What they do in practice typically is that the pad has a certain length and you're out of numbers, and Monty only has that same length list.
And as the length of our message grows, we keep recycling the path and start from the top set. We try to come up with clever ways in, but basically we start at the top and just once we're in this position here, start adding two again, and then three as you go. And as soon as you do that, you're introducing patterns into the encryption. If you know that the letter E happens a lot more than other letters, you can start getting a sense for where the patterns are coming out and cracking. But if you have a pad of unlimited length, you can then take this message and encrypt it quite solidly without the pad, no dice as far as interpreting the message. Of course, on this end, if Monty has the same 2 and 3, he just subtracts, and that brings him back to the 5 and to the 7, and that's how he knows to put that back into ancient and high. Now, there's one other drawback to this scheme. The other drawback to the scheme is that somehow, before we trade our secret, I have to get this pad over to him, right? I have to get the 2 and the 3 and the other random numbers over, because we've got to have the same list, so that when he's subtracting exactly what I added in order to arrive at the original message. And if the whole problem was that somebody in the middle might be listening in, how do I get the pad over to him in a way that won't be surveilled? This is actually a problem. The best thing to do is I can hand him a floppy disk and say, you know, have a great trip off to Europe, and from now on we'll use the number on that floppy disk, just don't compromise the floppy, and away we go. So that's another problem with so-called symmetric encryption. All right, any questions on this much? Great. Oh, yeah, good question.
So long as the pad gets sent in directions of what to do with the numbers?
Yep. There could be a commonly agreed algorithm for what to do with the numbers. Of course, this is almost like an open source versus proprietary code system. You can imagine being quite open about once you have the numbers, here's what you do. And still lacking the numbers, somebody in the middle, even though they know how it works, without the key, there's nowhere you can go. And that's why, if you think about with an open source encryption scheme, where you actually know the mechanics of, oh, I see, I add and then I subtract, or something far more complicated, where that part is revealed, can still be quite secure so long as you actually keep the pad, the key, as it were, secret. But yes, that's right. Okay, so that's symmetric encryption. So then, as you read, Whitfield and Diffie, quite interesting guys. And I don't know, I at one point said to the class that computers read a privacy prospectus, that conference is happening next spring. Whitfield and Diffie often go to this thing. So it's in Cambridge this year, so I encourage you all to know next spring. And maybe to close the panel or to ask them hard questions or something. Bring Jack to Lindy back. Okay, so they came up with this idea of public key encryption. And this thing, it does have an element of beauty to it. It is an unbelievably good idea, worthy even of a patent. And how does public key encryption work? Well, I'll tell you about one flavor of it. One flavor of it, and here's the idea, that it's really easy to multiply numbers together. You can do that in Snap. You give the computer numbers, and boom, it multiplies them, and tells you the answer. However, if you give a computer a number, and you tell it to find the factors, which is to say, what numbers you multiply together to make you, the computer has a much harder time doing that. It's not impossible, but it's hard, and in fact, the bigger the number, the harder it is. And I can give you an arbitrarily big number really fast. I can just multiply like hell and get to a really good big number, for which then you just tell me how big you need it to be, and then I can impose more and more algorithms upon you to figure out how the number is to be factored. I didn't know the ingredients going in. So that is a mathematical fact of life that appears to be true until someone disproves it. It hasn't been totally worked through yet. So if somebody can have a breakthrough in which they find out how to factor stuff really fast, but for right now, factoring takes lots of time. So because of this, you can take that fact and build what are called one-way functions. What is a one-way function? A one-way function is a function by which you can put something in one end and get something out the other deterministically. But once you have that something out the other end, you can't reverse engineer and figure out what went in very easily. It's just like source and object code. So
Source code leads predictably to certain object code. Object code can be hard to come into source code. A one-way function is not on steroids. It's really hard to go backwards once you have the output of the function, even though there's only one right answer. And if somebody points it out to you, look, this is what I put in, you go, oh, geez, you're right. That's the answer. That's the undoing of the one-way function. But without it being handed to you on a platter, you can have a Cray supercomputer and still be quite baffled at how to work backwards, even though it was, you know, the little professor calculator that did the one-way function to take a number in one end and give you a bigger number out the other. So once you've got these one-way functions and accept that they exist, you're able to generate pairs of keys, so-called public and private key. It's too bad that those both start with P, unless one is a public key and one is a private key. Now neighbors upstairs, so it's going to get noisy out there, I think, in the next 5 minutes, but we'll stay focused. Okay, so these keys have a certain relationship to each other, and I'll just explain how it works in practice. I generate two keys on my computer, a public one and a private one. The private one I don't tell a soul. I keep it secret just in my computer. That's the input. That's according to the source code. That's the thing that went into my one-way function. My public key can be what comes out the other end. And I'll hand that out to anybody who wants to listen to it. Here's my public key. And here's a neat thing you can do. With a public key, you can take a message, apply the public key to it, which is in a sense a way of generating a pad, and what comes out the other end is a big pile of junk. And if somebody tried to understand that junk, they would not know what the original text was, even though they have the public key. They know what went into making it, and they can't unmake it. It is an omelet for which the ingredients are simply unknowable, even though we have the public key, which is what enabled you to start with an egg and end up with an omelet. So what happens is the only way to go back from this pile of junk to the original message is to apply the private key. So if you take this equation and you then feed it into this one, then you get back to the message. This means that the act of my broadcasting, my public key to the world, is my act of telling the world, here's how to tell me a secret. I'll give you my public key, you take a message, and you work my public key into it, and what I get is the big tilde sign, junk. Then the only person who can undo that tilde back into high is the person who holds the private key, and I'm the only guy that has the private key. Yeah?
You
can think of it that way.
What's the relationship between why this discovery has to be how hard factoring is?
Because it is true that these keys are generated as two answers to the equation that's in the little box in the Scientific American article in the reading written by Phil Zimmerman. And that little box which shows how it's whatever it is to the x power
right.
I. Oh, look at this box again. After looking at this, and all will be out there. But basically, that box shows how you can have two missing things. You feed in one thing, and that's an issue where it's hard to do division. You're right. And so it's hard to go backwards to the other. It's thanks to the existence, and I agree, I'm not giving you the math here, so you have to take it on paper. It's thanks to the existence of being hard to factor, but easy to multiply, that we can generate key pairs that have this bizarre relationship with one another. A public key for which we know the public key that gave us the tilde, but we can't, with it, get back to the original message. The only way to get back to the original message easily is to apply the private key. So notice now, when I go to the trouble of sending out a public key to the world, it's not how I can tell the world secrets. I can't. It's just how the world can tell me secrets. So a typical relationship between people who want to have a secret conversation in cyberspace starts with an exchange of public keys. And that exchange of public keys could be quite public. Remember, the public key doesn't have to be kept secret. So I go up to Monty and I say, here's my public key. He says, thanks very much. Here's my public key. And from then on, if I want to utter a secret statement to him, I use his public key to generate the omelet, ship him the omelet, and then he uses his private key to decrypt it. And if he wants to answer me, he uses my public key to ship me an omelet, and then I use my private key to decrypt it. Does that make any sense? Yeah.
I use your public key to open an omelet. Did you get my message? Someone you in your private key.
Correct.
Not as I could use your public key to decrypt it, so that I could use my private key.
That is absolutely right. Now there's just one more twist to this that's really cool, and this is what Lessig's getting at with. It's not just about keeping secrets, it's also about authentication, about being able to make certain statements about yourself. So far we've just said how I can exchange a secret with somebody. But the interesting relationship here is, I can also take a message, apply my private key to it, and send junk out to the world. Now why would I do that? I would do that because I can say, hello world, here's a pile of junk, and if you apply my public key to it, you will see a message pop out. And because a message pops out with the use of my public key, you can rest assured that the only thing that generated that junk was my private key. And if in fact the only thing that generated the junk was my private key, then it must be that I am the source of the junk, because I'm the only guy who knows my private key. So it works backwards as a means of authentication. So to digitally sign a message is the act of taking some chunk of the message, this is what's called a hash function, but some chunk of the message, applying your private key to it, generating junk, sending the junk to somebody, and then the only way that the junk translates back to something that compares to the original message is with the application of my public key. Therefore, it must be me who is the source of the message. See here? Well, public keys can be generated on the fly. So in the course of the day, it's not like we're all walking around with public keys around our necks. We just don't know what they are. But they will get generated like that. Every time you see that stupid little key appear in Netscape, or that lock appear in Internet Explorer, it means that a public key has been generated for you for that particular session, and you are communicating securely to somebody that you forgot the next time. It's so easy to do. And indeed, there exist telephones that exchange digital data, for which the phones just generate public keys and trade them, and then you can encrypt the conversation with them. And that's the third rail. That's what the government is quite afraid of, because they get a lot of useful stuff out of surveilling phone conversations. When I worked for the State Department, we would use secure phones. And it was very Maxwell Smart. It's like, you push the button and it just blocks noise. And it would sound like you were talking to like a frog. And eventually, you have to shout really loudly. And in the embassy in Ecuador, you would always know there was a top secret call going on because the guy's bellowing in his room. You know, the treasure is buried in the Adriatic. You know, and they're afraid that that very technology could leak out to the public at large. And the so-called secure telephone, the suit, could just become a princess phone. You buy a Radio Shack and walk. But then also realize that this is where it is both a threat to order, it is a pro-anarchy thing, that with strong encryption, we can start trading messages to each other and nobody in the middle can have a clue what we're doing. Properly implemented, you can make it so that you're listening to Nutella and FAS Network Services has no clue. All they know is you're using bandwidth. That's not yet how Nutella is implemented, but you can do it. And at the same time, thanks to this authentication technology, you can utter statements about yourself that only you can utter. Which means you can voluntarily say, I am Jay-Z, you know that, and therefore you can let me in. Or you could say, I am the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and you know that the following message really does come from the Commonwealth. And what could be within the message from the Commonwealth? Johnson Train is over 18. And when that happens, we have the Commonwealth of Massachusetts able to authoritatively declare in an instant that I, in fact, am over 18. And in fact, I don't even need to fill in the name. I can just say, I'm a person who is over 18. If you don't believe me, ask the Commonwealth. And there you get into a quick dance among multiple parties on the internet in a click of a mouse by which people can utter difficult to repudiate authoritative statements about each other. And thus, then you end up in a world in which you can become quite known to websites. We can tell the kids from the adults because we now have an easy way of sifting them out from one another. I guess we're going to have to continue as we still have 5 minutes left. But I want to use those 5 minutes for an exercise of sorts. We also, like you may know about this, we're at a somewhat of an inflection point for the class. So I have in my hand a ream of paper, which I'm about to distribute. And I would very much appreciate it if you could answer 3 questions on this sheet of paper that you're about to get. The answer are 500 sheets, so somehow it should quickly disseminate. Thanks a lot. Question number one. What's your biggest thought? And I'm not trying to be too cute by half by putting it that way. I'm just sort of asking, what's on your mind right now? It can be about the substance of the course. It can be about the procedure of the course. What's on your mind right now coming out of a fairly active period of the course with all these events back to back? If you must insist that it's, when can I go see Nader or what's for dinner, fine, that's your biggest thought. I can't analyze it today. So what's your biggest thought? Second is, what's your biggest question? If there were a question you could put out there right now, what would it be? I don't want the biggest to somehow jam you up. Because when it's like, what's your biggest? Then you start weighing, what is a big question? And it doesn't have to be the biggest. Just what's a question you have at this moment in time? So you sample prospectively what's going on. And the third question is there anything you want to say directly to me? Or is it back up to John? Anything you want to say directly to us? So those are the 3 questions. And at the bottom of the page, you can put your name. If you don't want to put your name, don't put your name. If you do want to put your name, that'd be great. And I can actually respond individually as appropriate if I have a name to which you respond or email address. Finally, do you mind if this is shared? Once this thing gets turned in, is it okay if someday you throw up a PowerPoint slide with your comment or your question on it? Is it okay to share it? And if you say no, it won't be shared. And if you say yes, it's no guarantee it will be shared. It's just enabling such things. This is known as a feedback demo. It's quite a foreign animal at the Harvard Law School, but I'd like you to know. So that's what I'd love to do for the next 5 minutes. And I'll select something off my music box. Whichever music I have. Thank you. The rotisserie questions for this week are only two, and one is, what is your abstract? So that's the way you're getting your paper proposed today. And question two will be something interesting about next week's meeting, and that one will be appropriate. That's what's been on the paper. And there'll be obviously a chance to deviate from what we propose as time goes on. And I'm trying to pile on extra office hours to make up for my banana process that this week for next week.
And also, whoever people who submitted possible class proposals, we will tell you by tonight that you're going to take the class.
Okay,
well,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, and if you're not, just bring your memo to stay up here and join Ralph later. That's going to be great success.
Thank you.